next Truth Quest with Melody.
Too many people in America fear their government, and the government is being run by too many powerful agencies like the IRS and others. I think it's time that people take the country back through their representative government.
Good evening. This is Truth Quest, and you're with Melody, and this is KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado, and community supported radio. And we're streamed on the internet at khen.org. And if you would like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they are available at www.givemesometruth.info. or linked from the khen.org website. And if you would like to send an email into the program for any questions with our guest, our email address is khen.dj@gmail.com. And my co-host tonight is Shannon Hemingway, and you just listened to Poker Face, and of course the song was Revolution, and the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guest and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And our special guest this evening is Charles Hall. And Charles was born and raised in rural Wisconsin, USA, near Madison. Charles enlisted in the United States Air Force on July 20th, 1964, and he was stationed at Nellis Air Force Base outside Las Vegas, Nevada, for over 2 years. While there, he served for extensive periods of time as a weather observer in the desert on the Gunnery Ranges at Indian Springs, Nevada. Following this, he served a year in Vietnam in the Mekong Delta. Charles received an award for surviving more than 35 communist attacks. A year after receiving an honorable discharge in May 1968, Charles married Marie on the condition that he would go to college. In record time, he earned both a bachelor's degree in thermal physics and a master's degree in applied nuclear physics at San Diego State University in San Diego, California. Charles got his PhD level postgraduate work at the University of Maine at Bangor. Later, he earned a master's in business administration from Nova Southeastern University at Fort Lauderdale, Florida. When Charles and Marie had been married about 3 months, Charles decided to risk telling her about the extraterrestrials he had encountered at Indian Springs. Marie wasn't terribly interested in whether or not ETs existed. She only said that if she met one, she hoped they would behave properly. That might just be another way to describe the current buzzword for exopolitics. And raising a family pushed memories of the terror and the unprecedented experiences on the Indian Springs Gunnery Ranges into the background, but they couldn't be forgotten. So in his spare time, Charles began writing his memoirs for his children and grandchildren. 18 years later, when Marie discovered what he had been doing, she convinced him to publish, found it easy to come up with the title, cover, design, and helped edit what eventually became the Millennial Hospitality series. Now for 4 books. Marie particularly liked Charles' memoirs because they did not attempt to prove the existence of extraterrestrials, but rather could be read and enjoyed by everyone. They read like a novel, and the reader can learn about how to be a better human being because the nature of the material and to protect the innocent, it seemed prudent to change the names of friends, places, and a few distances and directions. The Millennial Hospitality series without precedent and a truly groundbreaking account of one man's actual experiences with the extraterrestrials in the Nevada desert. It is already being hailed as a classic. And of particular interest, Charles Hall's first paper describing his photon theory is included in the appendix of the Millennial Hospitality 3, The Road Home. And further writing is included in the Millennial Hospitality 4, After Hours. The Hall photon theory maintains that Einstein's theories fell short. And if scientists accepted the hypotheses presented, vehicles can be built which will travel faster than the speed of light. In addition, the fourth book no longer disguises place names, such as a section of credible updates and answers to frequently asked questions. And Charles is currently working as a nuclear physicist and database manager. With all the children grown, he and his wife Marie maintain their empty nest in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And we're going to bring up Marie, his wife, first. And Marie, are you there?
I am, Melody, and thank you so much for letting me put in my 2 cents worth. Charles and I will be celebrating our 40th wedding anniversary in a couple of months. And I just go back to when I first met him. You covered a lot of things in the bio that you just read. But what happened is Charles had back at the University of Wisconsin, he had gotten the Hong Kong flu, I think, the day that he was supposed to take tests, and needed the dean's permission to continue. That, of course, was before he went into the service. Well, when I told him he had to finish school and get his degree, he wasn't about to ask the dean's permission for anything, and he convinced me that it would be fun to go out to California. So I was doing substitute teaching and also managing an apartment complex in Sacramento while he was finishing up his associate's degree at Rockland Junior College. And that was when he, what happened is we'd been invited to a party. You know, these people didn't want the police called, and so they thought the way to get around that would be to invite the managers to the party. And we were young at the time. We were both 25. So we went to this party, and I guess the talk at the party annoyed Charles, you know, and he said, you know, let's go home. And so we were laying in bed in our apartment, and he said, you know, those people at the party really did not know what they were talking about. And he said, I said, you mean Vietnam? And he said, oh, no, no, Vietnam was, you know, what you might expect. It was the war and everything. He said, no, I'm thinking of the terror that happened to me when I was a weather observer out on the Indian Springs gunnery ranges. And this is when he told me about the extraterrestrials coming into his barracks at night when he was asleep. And at the time, I guess I just thought it was something that happened once or twice. I had no idea it was something that had happened, you know, on pretty much a daily basis for over 2 years. And as you mentioned at the time, I said, all I hope is that I would behave in a manner that was a credit to the human race. And, of course, we just spent the next 30 years after that raising a family. I have 6 children. And it was when Charles was 58 that I came into the computer room, and he shut the screen real fast. And I said, what are you doing? And he said, I'm working on a book. And I said, really? Because I couldn't get him to write 3 sentences to his mother. I didn't really think of him as a writer, but he'd apparently been doing this in his spare time for over 18 years. And I said, well, there's no way I'm going to look through all the files on your computer to find a book. I said, why don't you print some of it out? I'd like to read it. And I think I read maybe only 20 minutes, and I came back in, and I said, we're publishing this. And he said, no, I don't think so. You know, even if you don't say anything bad about somebody, they could sue you. And I said, oh, Charles, you just do the standard thing that writers do and put a disclaimer in the front of the book and change the names of your friends to protect them and yourself. And he said, no, you know, the Air Force really never told me I couldn't talk about any of this, but on the other hand, they haven't been exactly forthcoming during the last 40 years. And I said, so change the place names, too. And he was still very reluctant, very unconvinced that this would be a good thing to do. And I said, at the time, he was actually had been unemployed for a month. He'd come to the end of a contract, and it actually turned out to be a rather lengthy unemployment because, of course, when you're 58, it's easy to have nice job interviews but not get hired. You know, they might go for the guy who's 38 or 48. So anyway, I just said to him, honey, you're unemployed. If the men in black come to our front door, you should go with them. It's free room and board. And then he started laughing, and he said, you're right. What have we got to lose? So that's how the book started. It was actually a lot of work because many of the files were on an all but buried Tandy 2000 out in the garage. We had to, you know, coax these files out of the machine and then, of course, reformat it. And there was a lot of editing that I helped him with, too, because in particular, he served with men from all over, you know, men from the Bronx, blacks from the South, and he had tried to imitate their vernacular, and I said, honey, these books are probably going to be read all over the world, and I think they'd be more readable if they were written in decent English. And also, I felt it was a good way to honor all of the service people that he served with. I mean, if there's a movie, surely they should put different people with different accents in and so forth. But I thought for the literature that it would be just the best plan to do it in good English. And I think it was wise because I have personally shipped books all over the world, Australia, Germany, Ireland, England, India. And so anyway, the books are selling well, and we enjoy meeting our fans, and Charles enjoys talking to our fans. It was fun meeting you up in Nevada, Alamo. We enjoyed that this past summer. But
did you have quite a few people show up to that?
Pardon?
Did you had quite a few people show up to that?
Well, actually, it was a very small conference,
okay.
So you had a chance to visit with everybody there if you wanted to.
Uh-huh.
So, but anyway, I guess I don't need to say much more as an introduction to Charles because people, when you Google his name, I guess you get 250,000 sites. So it's very common for people to know way more about us than we ever expected, even though they may not have read the books, which I think are a totally different experience. I mean, I was just amazed that he could remember all of this stuff to begin with, and that he was so patient about, you know, walking you through it. It's a first person account about those very simpler times in the mid 60s that, you know, a lot of our readers, of course, weren't even alive to remember. So,
well thank you very much for
giving
us a,
and I'll put Charles on.
Okay.
Hello.
Hello, Charles.
Oh, hi, Melody. let's see. Am I speaking loud enough?
Oh yeah, you're fine.
Okay. Are we on the air?
Uh-huh.
Well, good. Since it's your show, I'll let you ask the questions.
Well, now what I'd like you to do is just kind of get, you know, kind of do like you've done on some of the videos and that sort of your conferences, is just kind of give a brief, you know, talk about your background a little bit, and then get into how your experience there at Area is.
Sure, I'll be happy to. once I get started, I can talk for hours. In July of 1964, when I was 19, I enlisted in the U.S. Air Force. And I did 13 weeks of basic training at Lackland Air Force Base in Texas. And I'm a Vietnam vet. Excuse me for coughing. I have had a few allergies, but I feel fine. I have some water here next to me. When you go in the Air Force, they give you lots of tests to see what you're good at. And I got a perfect score in logical reasoning ability, deductive and inductive reasoning. And so they were, and I also got perfect scores in all sorts of other things. And I got one wrong on the math ability test, which was the Air Force highest score, one wrong out of 500. And so they were going to give me a security job called Radio Intercept Analysis, RIA. And to do that, I had to have a top-secret clearance, and they were going to send me to San Angeles, Texas. So after basic training at Lackland, me and two other guys who were in the same group, we were put into PATS standings to wait for our orders to come through to San Angeles. In the meantime, they cut, for me, a set of cover orders to go to weather school at Chanute Air Force Base, Illinois. And the idea being that if my clearance didn't come through, then they'd send me, make me a weatherman. But the cover orders also allowed me to do things like get paid and stuff like that. And on the Friday when the orders came in, my clearance came through, my orders were kept separate. They were in a safe in the squadron office. And the captain who was supposed to give them to me was out playing golf. And one of the other airmen who was also awaiting orders, he was the desk clerk, and he didn't realize that I had a second set of orders. So when the orders came through, he gave my two friends their orders to RIA school and me my orders to weather school, not aware that there was orders for me in the safe, too. So I went to Chinook Air Force Base, Illinois, and after a couple months, I wasn't getting paid, so I went over to see the base commander, and the base commander was went over to see the payroll section, and they were very upset that I was there, and sent me back to the weather school class where I was. And the next day, two policemen, air policemen, came in with the dog and escorted me over to the base commander's office. And he said, "Mr. Hall, Airman Hall, if you have a set of orders showing you're supposed to be on this base, then you'll be a happy man. And the captain who gave them to you, it's my understanding, may get 5 years in Leavenworth. On the other hand, if you don't have a set of orders, then he will be a happy man, and we don't know what we're going to do with you because you're too valuable to be wasted as a weatherman." And I had two copies. I was very nervous. I was just an enlisted man. And so they sent me back to finish weather school. And then when they sent around the wish list to say, where do you want to get sent, I asked for Europe, and I asked for England and Germany and March Air Force Base, Los Angeles. And the sergeant said no, it was his understanding that the Pentagon wanted me at Nellis Air Base, Nevada, outside Las Vegas, and that's where they sent me. Excuse me. So in March of 65, I reported for duty at Nellis Air Force Base. And as I describe in my books, especially in Millennial Hospitality 4 and also in 1, I was hardly there, and the Pentagon wanted me sent to Indian Springs, to the gunnery ranges. I'm skipping over a lot of details, because and I can come back, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have. And I try to describe how it was to live those days, without foreshadowing, how it was. I try to capture the emotion of those days and convey that to the reader.
Just a second, before you go on, why don't you give us your website where the books are located?
Sure, they're at www.millennialhospitality.com, and everything in the four books is true and happened to me, including the Hall Photon Theory, the physical theories that are in the appendix of Book 3 and Book 4. I now have a master's degree in nuclear physics, and I believe that I understand where Einstein went wrong, and I'll cover that as well. I'm getting over this cough. Boy, then I'll really be able to talk. And when I got so in the early spring of 1965, the Pentagon wanted me sent to Indian Springs, which was the Nellis Gunnery Ranges, and I described those in book four as well as in book one. And what I discovered when I got up there is that there was a base in the mountains at the northern end of Indian Springs Valley, which the Air Force maintains for extraterrestrials. The base, physically, when you're in Indian Springs, Nevada, and you're looking straight north up the valley, there's those mountains are like 40, 45 miles away, and I've been up in all those mountains. And when you look straight north and a little bit to the east, that's Area 54, and it's inside the Area 51 perimeter. And there's the main hangar is dug into that mountain. It faces towards the southeast. And when you look straight north and a little bit to the west, that's Area 53. And that's where the alien living area is. They live underground in tunnels, and to get to their living area, those mountains are honeycombed with tunnels. And when you look straight north and across the mountains to the east to Dogbone Lake, that's where their deep spacecraft came in and left on schedule. And that whole section of Indian Springs Valley, the whole northern section, the mountains on both sides, and the whole western half of the next valley over where the desert, where the game range is, that whole area was called Dreamland. Now, Area 51 was never called Dreamland. It was only called Groom Lake. And Area 52 was never called Dreamland. It was only called Papoose Lake. But that section to the north is the original Dreamland. And my orders allowed me to go up in there anytime I wanted, day or night. But I had to do so alone. Everything I did out in the ranges, I had to do totally alone. If I'd ever taken anyone with me, I wouldn't have been in any trouble. But whoever I took with me would probably not have come back alive. In September of 1965, for example, there were two hunters who rented horses down at the ranger station down to the southeast, and they went up through Corn Springs, and they were both carrying 50 caliber rifles. And one hunter stayed with the horses at the last water hole, while the other hunter, with his 50 caliber rifle and some canteens and stuff, went walking up across Dogbone Lake and up those mountains, approaching them from the southeast. The FBI announced that he died in a hunting accident. According to the FBI, he died because he was shot in the heart with his own rifle at point-blank range, 50 calibers, one bullet. And when the extraterrestrials who live up in those mountains that I call the Tall Whites, you see in my books that for the first 6 months I was terrified of them. But after a while, I got to where I made friends with, or they made friends with me, depending on your point of view. I got to where I overcame my fear, and I made friends with a few of them. The teacher, Range 4 Harry, tour guide. I was credited with saving his life, and the teacher's daughter. I was credited with saving her life. And we became friends, as described in those books, although each one is an individual. And so it's like saying, well, I have friends in New York City. You know, come midnight, if you're down in the docks, you may not be looking at any of your friends, you know. So each one is an individual. And when I was talking with them about that hunting accident, they told me that he had gotten in between the double perimeter, those mountains, when I speak from direct experience, they have a double perimeter around them, and then the human guards maintain the outer perimeter, and the tall white alien guards maintain the inner perimeter, and in between the two, those two perimeters, it's kind of a no man's land. And he'd gotten in between those two perimeters and taken a shot at one of the tall white children. And the tall white guards came out and hypnotized him, you know, stunned him, and then called the human guards. And the human guards came out, and the tall white guards released him, you know, to the human guards. And according to my tall white friends, the human guards sat him down on the rock and said that he would want them, that if he knew what was up in the mountains, he would want the human guards to shoot him rather than release him to the tall white guards. And so without mercy, they put a bullet in his heart and killed him. That's what my alien friends told me. And it used to be kind of an understanding that the only person that ever had the courage to go up in there alone was me. Although there were many, when I say had the courage, that doesn't mean every day I had the courage. That means it took me a long time to get the courage to go up the valley. And, you know, and I describe some of those days in my books.
Yeah, and don't you also describe the fact that there was a whole lot of other people that had been there before you? That
yes, that's correct. There, the Indian Springs had four gunnery ranges, and as the duty range observer, I was up there alone. And at each one of those range, the weather shacks out on the ranges, there were log books. And a weather observer is supposed to maintain a log book every time he takes a report, and there's an inventory. There's a log book of for your inventory of balloons. There's a log book for your inventory when you take a weather report. There's another log book for things that you want to record for the next observer who might relieve you or the observers that come after you. And those log books went back 7 years from 1965. And according to the log books, there were approximately 41 weather observers who went up there before me. And originally, you went up there on temporary duty and at 6 weeks at a time. And then, you know, you'd be out there by yourself. You'd stay at the Indian Springs base. You'd bunk over at night at Indian Springs, and that's where you'd take your meals. And then you'd get up like at 3 in the morning and drive out to whatever range the base commander wanted you to drive out to. That's the Nellis base commander. And typically it would be range 3, but sometimes it was range 1, and on occasion it was range 2 or range 4. But typically it would be range 3. And then you're always supposed to take a weather report at 4:30 in the morning. You're supposed to fill a weather balloon with helium and attach a light for the night runs. And then you'd release the balloon, and then you'd fill it with a set amount of helium, and then you'd time the release, and you'd track it with a theodolite, which is a surveyor's instrument. And then because it had a known amount of helium in it, it would always rise at the same rate, 1,000 feet a minute. And then you'd track it, and you'd record those readings every minute, and then you'd do that for 10 or 15 minutes. It depended on how high the Nellis weather station wanted to track. And then you'd go into your weather shack, and there's a big ivory board there with, you know, for plotting things on. And then you'd plot up your results and compute the winds. And there was a phone, so you could phone Nellis. There was a phone at each of the weather shacks, so you could phone Nellis with the results. And then you could go in for breakfast, and then you could come back out, for, you know, after breakfast, and you could go in for lunch. And it figured to be, if you'd been out there alone, it would have been the best duty an enlisted man could have in the U.S. Air Force, you know. You know, the last run typically was, I don't know, 1:32, sometimes 3. It varied from day to day. There were no officers out there. If you were out there by yourself, there were no sergeants to hassle you. You know, you were in total charge of the weather shacks. And there were a few range maintenance men, and they would be, sometimes they would come out to, to pick up bombs that the planes dropped or to repair roads or stuff like that. But lots of times the ranges would be totally closed and I would be the only one allowed out there. And according to the, and when you, as I describe in my four books, according to the log books, including the log book of balloon usage and inventory and so on, the average weather observer didn't last more than a week or 5 or 7 working days before becoming compromised. Compromised meant a few of them got burned. Some of them got so terrified that they were given Section 8 discharges. The ones who got burned were given Section 8s as well. Others became so terrified of the place that they wouldn't actually go out there. They would just get up in the morning and go over to the chow hall and make up the winds, just, you know, write down any number that came to mind, phone Nellis and hand in fake winds. Rather than drive out to the ranges and take the weather report, others would never go out there alone and would only go out there if they had another range maintenance man or a second one with them. And when I got sent up there in 1965, the range maintenance men who were there told me that there was an alien base dug into the mountains at the north end of the valley. You know, at the time, the only reason I didn't break out laughing was because, there were so few of us and we were out in the desert and a man needed all the friends he could get. I didn't want to offend anybody. Later when I figured out that they were telling me the truth, it was a very humbling experience. I felt so stupid, There were lots of days that, as you see in my books, for the first 6 months, I believe I felt every emotion that a human could feel, and, terror being one of them. For the longest time, even when the aliens would come in close and you'd get a real good look at them, I thought I was nuts, I thought I was dreaming. Remember that there's more to physics than what Einstein knew about, and the aliens knew that, and the suits they wore allowed them to levitate when they turned the suit on. Now, if they just came in ordinary street clothes, then they were just flesh and blood creatures, just like you and I, afraid of dying, afraid of breaking a leg, and so on. When they were wearing the suit, if they powered up the suit, they could float on the gravity field, but they had to balance themselves. Well, naturally, the children were very good at it. So, like one night I was in my weather shack, and I was working up the computations, and I looked out the window, the small window that overlooked the table, and floating perhaps 50 feet or so in the air was one of the tall white children. And I thought I was nuts, and the only reason I didn't go outside to get a better look was because I thought it was my brain malfunctioning, On the other hand, the adults, wouldn't usually float like that because they did have to balance themselves. And as they got older, like we, they weren't as flexible. But it was very common for the adults, for the young adults, to do things like we had a control tower and we had range boards, and to use the suits the way you and I would use an elevator, to go out and stand next to the range boards, which were held up by telephone poles, and then to balance themselves by touching the side of the telephone pole and then powering up the suit and going up to the top of the range board. Well, of course, when I come out there at 3:30 in the morning and you see like a guy who's 6.5, 7 feet tall, all white, obviously not human, bent over the top of the range board looking at you, with the fluorescent zone of white around him, it was very easy for me to believe that I was nuts, or that I was dreaming, or that, there was some problem, that I was having some kind of problem with my brain. And so just realizing that they were actual, that it wasn't me, that took at least 6 months. And you see in my books, you see that getting to where I could just accept it was, there were nights I was too afraid to move my feet, So the first, I'm trying to capture those emotions in the book, in the books, and every one of them is real.
Mm-hmm. So how did you communicate with them?
Some of the tall whites had taught themselves to speak English. The teacher, for example, had been here, she and Range 4 Harry, that was their CIA names. I believe she had come here when she was about 5, and the tall whites live much longer than we do. They live like about 10 times longer than we do, so they live 600 or 700 years. And she had come here in the time of when Madison was president, and one of the tall white ladies, whose CIA name was Pamela, had been born here in that same time frame. And so, see, some of them had spoken English for 200 years, like she and Range 4 Harry. Others came here, and they were still working on learning English. Their natural language sounds like a series of bird sounds or meadowlark sounds or dog barks or horse whinnies. Their hearing is at least as good as that of a dog. And their vocal cords are so flexible that they can make all those sounds, sounds that we can't hear, you know, sounds that only a dog could hear, or they could. And so, it wouldn't be possible for a human to talk to them in their language. In order for them to talk to us, they have to learn English. Now, they also had electronics, and the electronics could tell what a person was thinking. And so if the teacher came and she could talk to you directly in English, or if she were wearing a helmet with the electronics in it, then she could place her thoughts in your mind and tell what you were thinking. The regulars, the ones who had been here for a long time, like Range 4 Harry, the teacher, tour guide, and so on, they were all very skilled at using those kinds of helmets. Now, the helmets also let them communicate between themselves, and the power setting, because it's done with electronics, is adjustable. And so they could, you know, like they could set it to receive only, in which case you'd be out there and you'd never know that they were out in the sagebrush, you know, hearing everything that you were thinking. Now, but it only worked if you were healthy and relaxed and calm, you know, maybe singing or something. It didn't work if you became afraid, or if you were sick, or if you were really tired, or if you became emotional. It didn't work if you were walking or running, because the part of the brain that gives orders to the muscles puts a lot of static into the system. So, you know, like as I describe in book one, when I'm sitting there, the night I was sitting there in the rain, with my back to the side door at the range, at the weather shack at range one, I'm sorry, at range three, and the teacher was out in the rain and I was just sitting quietly reading a book, she could tell everything I was thinking, and she could put, you know, her thoughts in my mind. And if you didn't know that they could do that, you'd think you were just talking to yourself. On the other hand, if there were several of them in close and they had the equipment turned up high, you couldn't hear yourself think. And so the electronics, it had its good points and its weaknesses. But like if a new guard showed up, as I describe in book four, if he didn't speak English, if he hadn't taught himself yet to speak English, and if he wasn't wearing the electronics, then the only way you could communicate with him would be with hand signals. You know?
You describe some of the sampling in your book about some of them going into like Las Vegas.
Yes, that's true.
I mean, it struck me as like a scene from the movie They Live.
Excuse me. Yes. Well, see the tall whites throughout most of their adult life. Each one is an individual, but throughout most of their adult life, they're the same height that I am, 5'11". 6 feet, something like that, in that range. And they're more frail than we are. So range 4 Harry, who was the same height I am, 5'11", based on the depth of footprints that he left in some soft dirt over by the range 3 lounge, he only weighed between 90 and 110 pounds. So they're very frail. Their eyes are about twice as large as ours, and they stretch somewhat further around the side of their head. And their skin is as white as a piece of paper. But, excuse me. But for the young women, it isn't as noticeable as you might think, especially in a place like Las Vegas at night. A young tall white lady can put on makeup and dress up like a human lady, like the teacher in her favorite disguise was to dress up like a nurse, and with white skin, you know, nobody ever questioned a lady with white, you know, with some makeup on and in a nurse's uniform, and they enjoyed coming into Las Vegas. Of course, they never came in alone. They always came in groups with their guards and also with the CIA guards as well. And of course, if they spoke English and they were wearing the electronics so they could tell, you know, if a person was angry or if a person was going to attack them, you know, they could hardly have been safer, especially since the CIA was, you know, the government, they had the support of the U.S. government. They weren't, you know, if with the CIA guard, you know, they would come in with their guards around them and then with the CIA guards around them. And, excuse me, if you ever, you know, if they ever got in trouble, the CIA guards, you know, would, you know, the human guards would, you know, do the job.
Well, do you think the CIA went through the same type of adjustment that the other weather personnel had at the, you know, at the base?
I'm sorry for the cough. Let me make sure I understand your question. See, the other weathermen, like the guy before me, who's dead now, that I describe in book one and in the chapter entitled Four, It's the Government's Number, and the day I went up to relieve him, he had gone over the hill, and when he was out at Range 1 on a Sunday, he was, at the time, it was still going to be several months before he re-enlisted, and he was like real gung-ho and kind of, you know, trying to get promoted, and he was thinking of maybe re-enlisting. And as I describe in book one, he happened to encounter the teacher and one of the children, the one that I named the little fat astronaut, out at Range One. And in the confusion that followed, he took that scar on his left wrist, and I describe the details in book one, so I won't, you know, repeat them all here. Well, see, the next day, you know, he became hysterical and panicky and, you know, went into base. And the next morning, after breakfast, when he was out at Range 3, the next morning was a Monday, he described to me how he was sitting in the front door of the weather shack at Range 3. The weather shack was raised on wooden blocks, so you know, you had to step up to get into it, and you could sit in the doorway, you know, because the doorway was about as high off the desert as a chair is off the floor. And he said that as he was sitting there looking to the north, that an American three-star general and the teacher and the little boy stepped out from behind the Range 3 lounge, which is a building that I describe in my books, it was like 100 feet or so away from him, and just began walking and formed up into a line and line abreast, and just came walking in on him real slowly as he sat there. And he said that when they got to where the theodolite was, that, you know, since it was a general, he stood up and he started walking out slowly to meet them. And he said the general started talking to him. The general was saying, you know, Airman, I have some friends here that I'd like you to meet. And apparently the teacher was going to apologize for the commotion that had occurred the day before, because, you know, he did have a scar on his left wrist and the cut was still fresh. And apparently the general was going to make sure that he had been properly briefed, that they were friendly, and, you know, try to see to it that they weren't, you know, that to help him handle his fear. And he said that as he was standing there looking at the teacher from perhaps a distance of 20 or 30 feet, and he realized that she wasn't human, that he became hysterical again and took off running for his truck, while the general and the teacher and the little boy just stood there. And he said that he was hysterical as he drove back into base, and that he could never again go out to the ranges alone. And see the guys before me, you know, when you say, well, you know, would the CIA have liked to have gotten them to where they could interact with the aliens or so on? They, in all probability, they probably would have. But, you know, talk is cheap. When you're, you know, like as I describe in book one, the guy who, that one guy several years before me who had had the problem with alcoholism, when he went out that day to Range 4 and he was sick and perhaps hungover, and Range 4 Harry came and asked him if he needed help or wanted Harry to call for one of his friends. You know, he thought that he was seeing pink elephants because he had a problem with the bottle. And when he would go to the AAA, to the Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, he would say that he was the only person there, you know, whose pink elephants could help him if he got in trouble. You know, everyone else at the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting was saying, gee, I'm so afraid of my hallucinations. And so, getting to where you could just talk with them, you know, or where you could just be calm when they walked in on you, you know, I mean, it took a tremendous amount of work. The CIA guys that I talked to down at the Stardust, which was a so-called CIA safe casino, it was where the CIA, one of the CIA teams with pit bosses and dealers and stuff, used as kind of their base. One of the CIA guys down there told me that they weren't told anything. They were just told that those people were our friends and that they should be protected. And he said that I was the only one that knew very much about them and the only one that had the courage to go out to see them alone. One time I was talking with a guy who called himself the highest-ranked psychiatrist in the CIA, and he said that, when he had several PhDs, I think he had something like 9 of them. He said, he said that when he went to college and he was getting, you know, he was learning psychiatry. He said that he was told that humans had something like 105 or 107 different major psychological defenses. For example, whistling in the dark, or, you know, denying that or thinking that your eyes are playing tricks on you, self-denial, and so on. And he said that that he didn't think that any one human could use any more than three or four of them effectively, to protect himself. But he said that the thing that he found shocking wasn't the fact that I was perfectly logical. He said it was because just in the short meeting that we'd had in 15 or 20 minutes, he said that it appeared to him that I'd gone through like 65 or 70 different psychological defenses, and that I could switch from one to the other anytime I felt like it.
So, in other words, you're saying that you may have been a psychological experiment with them, and that you were being placed there because nobody else was able to adjust to that type of situation.
Exactly, yeah. And in effect, I became the welcome wagon lady or the welcome wagon person. And the zoo animal, you know, there, when the deep spacecraft would come in every month, there would be all sorts of new arrivals. The deep spacecraft would come in at sundown on the night of the full moon. If a deep space pilot had his choice, that's when he would come in. Sometimes the smaller ships would come in a day or two early or a day or two late if there were several of them, but the large ones, they always wanted to come in right at sundown on the night of the full moon, because that's when the gravity field behind the Earth in its orbit is smooth, and so it's like coming in on an aircraft carrier. Everything's nice and smooth and calm weather. Then they would be in port for 2 weeks, and if everything went well, they would repair and refurbish and refuel. And during those 2 weeks, the people on board, the new arrivals, would, you know, would be, they'd want to see the place, you know, the, just like if you
when
and
you're
I ta- would,
you're talking about the tall white. Okay.
The tall white.
And they're the ones driving the ship.
Yeah,
the
that's right, yeah. And then at midnight on the night of the new moon, when the moon is in between the Earth and the sun, at midnight you're facing directly away from the sun, and the Earth and the moon and the sun are all lined up. That's when the deep spacecraft would power up and take off, because they had nothing, because once again, taking off straight up at midnight on the night of the new moon, you're going out into the moon isn't in the way and the gravity field around the Earth is real smooth, and the deep spacecraft can easily travel faster than the speed of light, because relativity is just silliness. And I described that in Hall photon theory. So when they powered up, gee, they could take off. They could experience G-forces. The fields around the deep spacecraft, they have a double hull construction, protect the occupants and the craft itself from the forces of acceleration. If they didn't, I personally watched both the scout craft and the deep spacecraft take G-forces that I estimated to be in excess of 15,000 times the force of gravity, while the people on board just sat in chairs and like we do in our living rooms.
In other words, they didn't feel the difference in the G-force because of the compensation.
Yeah.
Okay.
But they could only do that when the ship was powered up, you know, when all the fields were powered up, especially the outer windings that would make the ship appear to fuzz over. And I described that in greater detail in Book 4. And, of course, 15,000 Gs, you know, I mean, their bodies are flesh and blood like ours, meaning they can't take more than 9 Gs. They can't take 9 or 10 Gs any more than we can. And 10,000 Gs will liquefy steel, you know. So, you know, to sit there and watch them take off at 15,000 Gs, I mean, they have to be, or even 40 Gs, it means there has to be more force fields than what Einstein knew about, because there has to be a force field protecting them from those forces of acceleration.
What type of field, what is the field that it's getting to be able to liquefy steel?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear your question.
What is the force field that's involved that's liquefying steel?
If you just built a rocket sled, and let's say it was steel, and you put a big rocket on it, and you were going to try to accelerate the rocket sled at 10,000 times the force of gravity, well, you'd liquefy the steel portion of the rocket sled just because you were trying to accelerate it too fast. You know, once you got to 10,000 Gs. If you were trying to build a steel tower and you had like steel beams and you had one, you had one that was so tall that the force due to the weight of the steel at the base exceeded 10,000 Gs, then the steel would liquefy, you see. If you were trying to accelerate the force of gravity, the acceleration of gravity is 32 feet per second per second, and if you were trying to do 10,000 times that with a steel rocket sled by, let's say you had like a big, took it out in space and you had like a big nuclear blast or something to really give it a push. Well, you can't accelerate a rocket. You couldn't accelerate a piece of steel, you know, by pushing on one end with a shock wave and then letting the molecules of steel push in the other molecules of steel and so on. You can't accelerate, you know, beyond that because you're just accelerating liquid. When you give too much energy to something solid, it will liquefy. That's true in earthquakes. For example, in the great San Francisco earthquake of 1906, some of the, you know, 8.6 on the Richter scale or thereabouts, give or take a few Richter points, we'll see some of the land in San Francisco during the earthquake, some of the soil turned into liquid. And so, like, there were pictures of, like, a fence that had been put in the soil, and during the earthquake, the soil liquefied, and the fence physically slid into the dirt the same way that it would if you took a fence and tried to put it out on a piece of water. And then when the earthquake stopped, the soil resolidified, see? So now you had, after the earthquake, you had, like, a stretch of fence that originally had been 5 feet tall, but now there was just the top 18 inches out of the soil, and you had to dig down to get the rest of the fence. See? And because when you try to put too much energy, either in the force of acceleration or in the force of vibration into something solid, for everything there's a level that will liquefy it. And but see, with the deep spacecraft, it had a double hull construction, and then in between those two hulls, there was like 1,000 miles of fiber optics in the case of the Scout craft, and many times that in the case of the deep spacecraft. And then what you'd run in those fiber optics were specific subatomic particles. I don't know which ones, but I know they were quite easy to produce. And see, what those fiber optics were doing using those subatomic particles is the same kind of thing that you do in an electromagnet. In an electromagnet, you have a copper wire, and you have the subatomic particle called an electron. And then you have all these windings, and you run the electrons through the windings, and that amplifies the magnetic field. Well, you do the very same thing in aliens are doing the very same thing in the deep spacecraft and in the Scout craft, where they have fiber optic windings, and then they pick a subatomic particle. I don't know which one, but perhaps it's the meson, you know, or the anti-meson.
Let me stop you for just a second here, because I need to do a station ID. And
sure.
You're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHENLPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio. And we're streamed on the Internet at khen.org. And my co-host tonight is Shannon Hemingway, and our guest is Charles Hall. And the views expressed on this program are those of myself and of my guests, but do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. Okay, go ahead and continue on with what you were saying, Charles.
Sure. In the case of the fiber optics, you see, the fiber optics are used to guide the particles the same way that in an electromagnet, a copper wire guides the path of the electrons, you see. Remember that when you send electrons down a copper wire, they don't go down the middle of the copper wire. They physically go down the surface of the copper wire, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, they themselves are spiraling as they go down the wire. And see, with fiber optics, when you pick one of the different subatomic particles and you send it down the fiber optics, it's also spiraling. You know, what you're doing is you're amplifying the force field that subatomic particle creates. So if that subatomic particle creates like anti-gravity, then you would be building something that would amplify anti-gravity. But the relevant point of Hall photon theory is that when you look at standard experiments in physics, you immediately come to the conclusion that there are more force fields than what Einstein knew about. In addition to electricity and magnetism, there has to be another force field associated with electricity and magnetism. When I was out there, it was the most common thing in the world for the tall whites to come out and shut down the engine on my truck. They had these little white weapon kind of things, and if I were driving out there with my truck and they wanted my truck to stop, all they had to do was fire at it with it's one of the different particles, and then what it would do is it would make it seem like there was nothing electrical in the truck. It would make it seem like the battery was dead, like, you know, no electricity would function. But then, after they had, you know, come out and played and done their thing, then there was a reverse particle where they'd fire at it with a different particle, and then all of a sudden you had the electricity back again. And you'll notice that in lots of apparently reliable UFO reports, many, many people have described how when a UFO, an alien kind of UFO comes close to their truck or to their car or anything electrical, how the force fields coming off the UFO will interfere with the electricity, like make the lights blink and so on. And that can, you can't do that with an electric field or a magnetic field. There has to be another kind of force field. In Hall photon theory, I try to summarize my belief that there are at least three other kinds of force fields that Einstein didn't know about. The day that I was sitting on my, which I describe in book four, where I was sitting in the doorway of the Range 3 weather shack, and I was watching a scout craft come out from the hangar, which was 40 miles, you know, up at the north end of the valley, coming down to where I was, you could clearly see, or I could clearly see, the action of three different force fields at work, none of which were known to Einstein. As soon as you realize that there's more force fields than what Einstein knew about, then it becomes immediately apparent that all of that stuff that Einstein said about relativity is silliness. For example, when Einstein said time slowed down if you approach the speed of light, that can't possibly be true. But if you wish to do the but if you were doing the mathematics and you weren't aware of what actually happens when you approach the speed of light, you might throw in this fudge factor that Einstein did, and say, well, let's pretend the time slows down when we approach the speed of light, just so that we can do the mathematics and try to get something useful. But to say that time in reality slows down when you move faster, I mean, as I described in book four, when I mentioned that to the teacher in Range 4 Harry, they were physically laughing so hard that they were rolling on the ground, which is one of the ways that the tall whites are slightly different than humans. I mean, humans can laugh so hard that they fall down laughing, but the tall whites, if you really tell them something funny, it was a little bit more easy. They were frail and they were more flexible, and they would do that more readily than a human. But she, you know, and then I remember the teacher when she got up and wiped the tears of laughter from her eyes and just said to me, she said, well, as you can see, we're here now. Relativity is, you know, Einstein started out with this mathematical approach called relativity, but then it got out of hand. People started believing that time for real would slow down when you traveled. But I'm certain that that wasn't the case for the tall whites. As I describe in book four, there was a two-month period when I'm certain that neither Range 4 Harry nor the teacher nor a tour guide were here on this planet. And I'm certain that they must have been, I'm certain that they were at one of the other tall white bases, which is not in this solar system, but is around some other star. Now, the closest star is 3¾ light years away. And to go there and come back at, you know, in 2 months, you have to travel at least 44 times the speed of light. And they're just flesh and blood creatures like you and I. They didn't go to other dimensions. I don't believe it's possible. They didn't travel in time. I don't believe that's possible. They didn't go through wormholes or, you know, stargates or portals or anything like that. I don't believe that that's possible in reality. They simply got onto a spacecraft and powered up and went very, very fast. And in order to do that, you have to have those extra force fields that I mentioned. But when they got back, they had been gone 2 months, and they aged only 2 months. They didn't, they hadn't traveled in time or anything like that. And see, in Hall photon theory, what I'm trying to do is to try to bring sanity back to the world of physics, as well as in my books, I'm trying to capture the emotion of how I felt when I was interacting with the tall whites and to convey that emotion to the reader.
Is there anybody that corroborates your theory at all?
Hall photon theory?
Mm-hmm.
Well, so far I'm the only one that's so far I'm the only one with Hall photon theory. My theory is that in a beam of light, where you have an electric field and a magnetic field in each photon, my theory is that there's a third field there, what I call the starshine field, so that the energy in a beam of light is oscillating between the energy and the electric and magnetic fields, is oscillating between those two fields and a third field. And therefore a photon would have to be made up of three quarks, not two. Now, in terms of collaboration for Hall photon theory, there's lots of experimental evidence, such as the Michelson-Morley experiment, where when you actually sit down and think about it carefully, you can see that Einstein had to be wrong and that the existing explanation has to be wrong.
What about Tesla?
I'm sorry.
What about Tesla? Any of his work fit in with this?
Now Tesla, I quote Tesla's diary from memory. He had these big Tesla coils outside Colorado Springs, and he ran a test, and it burned out the electrical generators for the city of Colorado. Colorado Springs, circa about 1920, and in his diary he was talking about the city engineers for the electric company, and he said, I quote, "They were madder than hell when they came out." It took him a week to get the city back online. Then he had to go off to DeForest, Wisconsin, to avoid the lawsuit. and see, he had this thing about really large amounts of energy. But he didn't have the theory. He didn't realize that there were more force fields involved, and therefore, when you look at his work, he didn't need those huge amounts of power in Tesla coils and stuff in order to show that there was more to physics than there were more force fields. He seemed to think, like many physicists, that in order to discover more force fields, that you had to have like high amounts of energy. You really don't. You just have to think carefully about what's happening with ordinary things like lasers and so on, and the Michelson-Morley experiment and the toroidal coils and so on, and you'll see that third field at work. And so Tesla's work, he accomplished a great deal, and it was quite interesting. But like so many physicists, he made the mistake of thinking that Maxwell's equations of 1864, which talk only about the electric field and the magnetic field, or its more primitive mathematical form, the displacement vector, and so on, but still just two fields. He seemed to think that's all there was to a radio wave, was just two fields. It isn't until you realize there's got to be another field in there that's where the doorway to more physics is when you realize it in a beam of light. Or in a radio wave, there's, in addition to an electric field and a magnetic field, that there's another field in there for the energy to be oscillating in and out from. That really what a radio wave is, or what an energy wave is it's really energy oscillating between different force fields and moving as a packet like that. And so Tesla, he built lots of nice things, but he wasn't a. He didn't. In terms of a theory, he didn't. He was like inside the box, in terms of the theory of what is a radio wave. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, can we get maybe a little bit less theory intensive here, Charles?
And sure.
I'm sure a lot of people aren't high energy physicists, although they may have heard some. Anecdotes about Tesla locally. I'm interested in your personal experiences where people are. I mean, we on this show kind of are always riding the edge of credulity in our own minds, and I'm sure in those of our listeners. when you talk about these creatures being flesh and blood, I mm-hmm. immediately wonder, okay, so you've touched their flesh and you've seen their blood?
No, I haven't touched them, but I've seen them, and I've seen them up very close, as I describe in my books. Mm-hmm. And I've also seen, and while I haven't seen their blood, the night that tour guide collapsed and they came out and gave him an IV, I did see their doctors giving him, you know, an intravenous, you know, a transfusion to bring it, you know, and to bring out their scout craft version of an ambulance and stuff. So I have seen them sick and healthy and tired and hungry and everything else. Yeah, they're totally flesh and blood. But I haven't personally touched them. They don't want to be touched.
Did you ever personally hand them an item or receive an item from them?
Oh yeah, yeah, books. Yeah, like in the barracks, as I describe, those three tall white ladies that were practicing to go down to be part of the technology exchange program and go down to Washington D.C. The lady that handed me my as I describe in my books, the lady that handed me my library book, and although remember, the tall whites never want to be actually touched by a human.
There's a description of an incident where a CIA person tries to help someone up a step at one point, and she becomes quite angry. What was the physical contact there, and why do you think that she was quite so angry?
Oh, well, the teacher, the CIA guy who was terrified of her, he told me that one Sunday, he and the teacher, she was dressed up to look like a human, that they had been in Washington, D.C., they'd been down at the Capitol building, and he had introduced her to some senators, not a large number, but to one or two senators, and he said that when they were coming down the west steps of the Capitol building, that because that he wasn't used to the way the tall whites, walk when they're going up and down steps, because remember their bones are much lighter than ours. And so their hips are slightly different, so they walk slightly differently than we do. And the teacher, of course, was not wearing high heels. She was just wearing low shoes. And when she was coming down the steps, he was walking beside her, and he made the mistake of thinking that she was going to trip and fall. And so he said, to steady her without thinking, he reached out and grabbed her by the elbow, the way you would, like if you were next to a lady coming down the steps, say on high heels, and you didn't want her to fall, the way you might, you know, go out and grab her by the elbow. And he said the teacher just about killed him. She said that she took out one of the weapons that they always carry, the one that puts out the sodium weapon. When they fire it on you, It'll make it feel like you're getting 120,000 volts AC through every nerve in your body, depending on the setting. And he said she had him down on his knees on the steps, and she was really angry. She was saying, do you think we're fools? Do you think I would come here if I couldn't walk up and down these steps? Do you think I don't know my own, you know, how to walk? And, you know, remember, she'd been here since she was a little girl. And he said, by the time, and all he did, you know, all he was able to say was, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, you know. And by the time she finished with him, and he said it took her like 10 or 15 minutes to get control of herself, he said that, you know, he was just absolutely terrified of her because, you know, with that weapon, she could just work, you know, she could have killed him if she'd wanted to. Could just work him over like a dog, you know. He thought I was the bravest man in the world to just walk up to her and say, hi, you know, how are you? Although I myself didn't walk up to her so much as I would take up a position and let her come as close to me as she wanted.
A lot of the things that you're describing sounds like either, you know, we were getting getting information or exchanging information back and forth, or reverse engineering some of their tools or that sort, because what you seem to be describing is things that I'm hearing about now as as viable and utilized by our government?
In 1965 and 1966, I'm certain that they had a technology exchange program with the Tall Whites. The U.S. government would give the Tall Whites anything they wanted, a base, food, anything, children's clothes, repair, you know, anything they wanted, in return for technology transfer. And the Tall Whites would decide what they were willing to transfer and what they weren't.
Sure, and these things are available on the web. Let's point out to people who may have just tuned in
sure.
in the last hour here that your website is, what is it, millennialhospitality.com, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Uh-huh.
Okay, and most of what you've said tonight is on those sites, in interviews and in the books itself. There's
mm-hmm.
a lot of references to the books. While we have you here live on the air, I'd like to follow some threads that, you know, take a little more advantage of you being here live. And one
sure.
of the threads I was trying to develop there was that, to someone listening to you, it seems like you're kept at a distance a lot. This latest story about the person on the stairs, that's hearsay. Did you ever feel like you may have been being kept at a distance because there was a impossibility, a holographic image before you, some other feeling that maybe you were being in other ways manipulated, since obviously there was a psychologist evaluating you at one point? And since we've heard from other people, about whom I really would like to ask you, some of them we've interviewed on this program,
sure.
what's your feeling on the idea of trusting your government and the information that you got about these creatures, and trusting whether you could really believe that they, A, were existing always in flesh and blood, or that you may sometimes have been seeing a hologram, and whether or not they actually were on the craft that you saw take off? That's two questions, I guess.
The creatures that I saw in every instance, and the craft that I saw in every instance, were real and were not holograms, or were not the result of mind experiments or anything like that. In the first 6 months, when I thought I was nuts, I tried every which way to convince myself that it must just be me, that it must just be my mind playing tricks. But like I remember one night I went out there for the morning run, and they'd gotten there before me. And as I stood from the edge of the generator shack, I watched them unlock the door to my weather shack, open up the door, and walk in. Well, you can't do that with a hologram, you know. When I got there, the door was, I stood there and waited for 10 or 15 minutes while the Tall Whites that were there and the children looked around and amused themselves. And then when they had their fill of everything, then they left. And then when I went over there, the door was open, and
sure.
And there was no way around it. Whoever had done it was real.
And
their craft the same way
okay,
was real.
So you only thought that perhaps your own mind was playing tricks on you.
That's correct,
hadn't really entertained the thought that maybe you were being tested, and that tricks were being played on you by a third party.
At the time, I thought it was me. Okay, but there's no question that in every case they were real, and that it was happening to me for real. Now, when you get really terrified, your mind will play tricks on you. Like that night out at Range 1, when I was really terrified, and one of the guards was standing at the intersection of the Range 1 road and the area for the Range 1, the gravel area for the Range 1 weather shack and stuff, I was so terrified that, you know, you could have convinced me that Abraham Lincoln was standing out there, you know, because I wasn't. Uncontrollable, but I was beyond tunnel vision, and so there were times when you'd be really terrified, when where your mind wouldn't let you see what you were looking at and stuff. But no, there was no thought control, or nobody was out there playing tricks on me or whatever. But you see, from the point of view of the U.S. government, the Tall Whites who were out on the base, they are totally real, and they have men, women, and children just like we do, and the women and children get bored, and the kids like to have a place to play. And so from the point of view of the U.S. government, they're not trying to play nobody's trying to play tricks on me. What they're trying to do is to let the women and kids go out and have fun and play with the kids while the tall whites in the U.S. government are doing technology transfer and working on joint projects. They're trying to do the same thing that, say, like if you were on a Navy base like at Rota, Spain, where the U.S. government and the Spanish government would be trying to make sure that the wives and the children of the U.S. soldiers or the U.S. servicemen had nice stores and, you know, things to do and, playgrounds and stuff while the men were serving their country, see? And so it wasn't an experiment where they were trying to fool me or trick me or, you know, anything like that. You know, remember, they are as naturally afraid of us or more so than we are of them. So when they would come with new arrivals who were supposed to take part in the technology exchange program, the tall whites had to go through a process of overcoming their natural fear of humans, mm-hmm. the same way I'd had to overcome my natural fear of them. So, for example, Lady Pamela, whom I'm certain headed up a technology exchange group that went into Lawrence Livermore after I left, well, see, she was terrified of humans, and so it took her, you know, she was the one that, the day of the accident, she was the one that accidentally fired on me and almost killed me.
I guess what makes me a little bit curious is how do we know that if there is that kind of technology transfer, and if these are from elsewhere, how do we know that we weren't developing that same type of being or doing genetic experiments or creating them ourselves? Does that make sense?
Well, I understand the question, but remember the day the teacher took me on board the scout craft down on the day they stopped me on the Range 4 road. The point of that meeting was she was pleasantly trying to show me that they were just ordinary extraterrestrials, you know, men, women, and children like you and I that happened to have come from a planet orbiting another star, that they weren't like monsters or anything like that. Because remember the day before that, one of my friends had been out at Range 3 with me, and they apparently had been listening in using their electronics. And he was the one that knew, he was one of the ones that knew they were real. He was the one that had seen them out at Range 4 in the hangars. And he was trying to tell me that he thought I was in danger, that he thought they were monsters, that they were very dangerous to be around. And he didn't think I should permit them to bring the children and play every morning when I was taking the weather reports the way I had been, because he thought that that's kind of like letting dangerous lions and tigers come in, or, you know, that they were, he specifically thought they were monsters or mutants. And of course, from the point of view of the teacher, if I start believing that, well, then the kids will pick that up, and then they, you know, the whole reason she's bringing the kids is so they can have fun playing. They like to look through my tan light. And so that'll destroy the happy playground. So from her point of view, it isn't a matter of teaching me or training me. It's a matter of showing me that they were just ordinary people so that they would be welcome when she brought the kids around, so the kids would have fun playing, and they'd do anything for their kids. So when she took me on board the scout craft, you know, down on the Range 4 road, and she was showing me, like, the mirror where she would put on her makeup and pretend to be, you know, dress up like a human. Well, when you went on board the scout craft, that was the RV model. It had, it had food. It was just like going onto an RV. It had, like, a microwave oven, only they had reworked it so it didn't have a door. It had a longer case, and then it had coils, fiber optic coils around it. So when you powered it up, it put out a force field that prevented the microwaves from going through from bouncing out into the room. It had a latrine in the back and a shower. It had hammocks for them to sleep in and food, you know, just like an RV, food storage and stuff. And that was her point, was to show them, was to show me that they weren't mutants, they weren't monsters, they weren't, you know, miscreants, they were just ordinary creatures. And that's what the universe was like. You know, they loved their children. The two mothers were very proud of the fact that they loved their children. Between themselves, they were very social. They loved each other. She was very proud. All of the tall white women were very proud of their family relationships. Who was their mother? Who was their brother? Who was their nephew? And the men were the same way. And the way it was just more noticeable in the case of the women, because the women were typically talked about that more. And so, no, they weren't the result of any government experiment. Now, some of the men weren't sure. Like one of the guys who knew they were real, he thought that they were a group of ancient Egyptians who had gotten trapped out there like 4,000 years ago, and this is how they look now. Because their writing, if you didn't know hieroglyphs, you couldn't distinguish the difference between their writing and hieroglyphs unless you actually knew hieroglyphs. But once you realize that there's a, you know, once you knew anything about hieroglyphs, then their writing was a lot different. Then you could tell the difference. But, you know, he thought they were ancient Egyptians. Another guy thought they were ghosts. Another guy thought they were a group of immigrants that maybe had gotten lost out in the mountains back in the 1800s. And now, you know, three, four generations later, this is how the miscreant, you know, this is how they looked after, you know, three, four generations. And so, you know, coming across them, trying to become comfortable with the fact that they're just people from another planet, you know, that was really hard, especially in the 60s.
Mm-hmm. As far as, why do you think you're able to talk about this sort of thing where most people that have had these kind of experiences experience a whole different type of silencing or ridicule or alienation, and or some of them don't even, you know, survive it, you know?
Well, to begin with, as I describe in book one, after that one friend of mine was burned, they formed a committee. The committee included the tall whites as well as the American generals, and they decided that they would stop the rotation program where one guy would go up there for 6 weeks and then another guy for 6 weeks and so on. They would just pick one person and just send him all the time. And then it was a committee vote. They all voted and they picked me and gave me my special orders as I describe in book one. And said, you know, and they wouldn't rope, and I describe all that in book one and in my other, and in the stuff out on the web. And part of that decision was that nothing I did would ever be classified. But the other side of the coin was no one could ever ask me questions. My own commander couldn't go out there and inspect me, or the sergeants couldn't come out there. As I describe in my books and in my other, and in my other talks, If my own sergeants wanted to talk to me, they had to come out and meet me in the parking lot of the chow hall at Indian Springs. They had to come out in pairs. Before they left Nellis, they'd have to leave before 10 o'clock in the morning and stop by the neurosurgeon's office, the base hospital, and be briefed. And then when they got back from Indian Springs, they would have to go directly to the neurosurgeon and be debriefed. And that was just to deliver me, that's just if they wanted to drive up and deliver me a paycheck. If they had supplies to bring me, then they would have, the only place they could meet me was in the parking lot of the chow hall, and then I'd bring my truck and they'd bring their truck and we'd transfer supplies. They couldn't, the rules explicitly forbid them from going to my barracks or anywhere. They could listen if I talked, but they could never ask me questions. Now, part of the reason is because the tall white mothers are very proud of their ability as mothers. Weather information is never classified, by the way, even in the Korean War it wasn't classified. The North Koreans, the Chinese, and the Americans all freely shared weather reports, even during the height of the Korean War. And look at it from the point of view of the tall whites. Suppose that what I did was classified. Well, consider the night when the teacher was out there with her children, and the children were playing up on the control tower, and I knew there were some loose boards up there, and the children were wearing their their suits, the ones that let them float, so they can't physically fall down, because the suits let them float and physically float up there. And I was somewhat worried because the kids were playing around one of those loose boards on the railing. But, of course, you know, to ever say anything directly to the kids would be suicide. You know, so I turned to the teacher and I said, well, I worry that, you know, because I know that there's some boards up there that are loose and, you know, I worry that the children might be surprised. And the teacher just smiled and said, there's no danger. They know how, you know, the kids are so used to the suits. And just went on talking about ladies' fashions and how she and some of the other young mothers wanted to go shopping in Las Vegas. Well, see, if that were classified, that would mean that there would come a time where I'd have to go in and talk to the classification people, to the intelligence people, and then they might ask questions like, do I feel the teacher is a good mother? Do I feel the teacher's been looking after her children properly? Well, my golly, to question a tall white woman to say, are you what kind of mother are you? My God, that's suicide. I mean, that'd be like a chimpanzee coming up to a human lady and saying, well, why aren't you raising your children the way monkeys should be raised? You know, I mean, see the American generals, there's no way in the world the American generals would risk that, because they'd do anything for technology transfer. So from their point of view, see, they didn't want the last thing in the world they wanted was anybody from the intelligence community asking me questions that would upset the tall white women. You know, all of those women come armed, and it wouldn't be a question whether or not I would complain to them. They can the tall white women, oh, they all carry that electronic stuff. They can tell what you're thinking. If that were the case, all it would mean is the next time a general went out there to talk to him, they would just read his mind, figure out that was going on, and then just like that CIA guard on the steps of the Capitol, they'd just jerk the sodium weapon and start asking questions and saying, what do you think we are, idiots? You think we can't protect ourselves? We built the spacecraft. We came here 200 years ago. You don't respect that, you know? So from the point of view of the American generals, when I say that the American generals would do anything for technology transfer, I mean anything for technology transfer. You know, if one of the enlisted men offended one of the tall whites and they chose to kill him, the American generals would say, well, you know, sorry, we'll get a brighter guy next time, you know.
So what came about that you were transferred out? Why would you think that they would want to, you know, eventually
not keep you? Oh, as I describe in my books, they gave me the choice. There was a day when I was in the parking lot down at Nellis, if I'd signed the paper, if I'd just said yes, they would have sent me to the Air Force Academy, made me an officer, and then given me orders that said I was in charge of the ranges for as long as I felt like being in the Air Force. And if I needed a break, I could be a pilot for a Herky Bird pilot and, you know, fly cargo planes to Europe and take as long a break as I want and then go back to Indian Springs. I'm not that military. When they sent me to Vietnam, they weren't intending to send me into combat, although that, as you see, I am that was the case. I ended up in the Delta, as I described in Book 3, and I got an award for defending in 35. I got the award after defending in 35 communist attacks, and then there were two more, but then who was counting to make 37? And see, I was supposed to go to Cameron Bay, which is just like going to San Francisco for a rest, only with the ocean on the other side, you know. So I was supposed to just be spending a year at Cameron Bay and, in rest and recovery. And then making the decision. But see, when they sent me to the Delta, you know, I was tired. I mean, I really wanted to just go home and rest. Being around the tall whites, remember, even when they're your friends, even when you know they're real and they're your friends and they're not going to hurt you, there's always a certain tension being around them because they really aren't human and I'm really not a tall white alien. And therefore, the way they handle anger and the way I handle anger as a human is different. Well, if it's so, when you were around them, it was so easy to forget that they're not human because they're so much like us. On the other hand, when I'm around them, it's so easy for them to forget that I'm not at all white because I'm so much like them. And they're, well, of course, if I ever forget that they're not human, and that, or they ever forget that I'm not at all white, then something's going to happen. I'm the one going to get damaged because they're the ones armed to the teeth. You know, I'm out there without nothing, see? And so, you know, I'm out there with just, you know, my willingness to participate, you know.
Is there anything to give?
So you see, being around them, you know, a human needs a break. You know, it's very stressful, in other words. Yeah. You, even when they're friendly, because, and even that, you know, I was out there for more than 2 years, and even when you get that used to being around them, and then there's another stress too, and that is that. If you're the only human that, you know, like when I was talking with my friend, and he was, that I described, and he thought they were monsters, and I'm saying, well, no, they're just people like you and I, flesh and blood. The women like to talk about clothes. He looked at me like I was nuts.
Don't you find that kind of strange? It's almost like they're being indoctrinated into the lingos and the things that humans, you know, kind of the small talk things that humans do. You think they would do that back where they come from?
When the new arrivals got off the deep spacecraft, they were indistinguishable. I mean, when you saw them from a distance, there was little difference between them getting off the spacecraft and walking around here on Earth and, say, a group of tourists getting off an airplane in Rome, Italy, certainly for them to be around humans, one of the ways that it changed them, in their words, were that humans like to do so much with animals. They don't have pets. They're plant eaters, and they don't naturally go out and play with animals and so on. And so, like, one of the ways that the teacher had been changed by her experience here in the Earth was, as I describe in my books, that they used to, you know, she and the children used to laughingly call me their favorite pony, you know, and that I was their favorite pet pony. Well, they don't naturally have pets, you see. So from their point of view, for me to be called a teacher's pet, that's like really humorous for them, you know, because normally a tall white wouldn't have a pet. And because they're plant eaters, you know. And see, so there was a certain, you know, from their point of view, being around humans did change them. I remember watching a group of three tall white young teenagers, equivalent perhaps to eighth graders, trying to get the dogs in the trailer court to bark and roll over and the way I had taught them to for me, and of course, you know, the dogs wouldn't do it for them, and of course they were terrified of dogs, but it kind of showed that for them to be around humans was having an effect on their culture too, and the effect was both ways. The big effect it had on me wasn't so much religious; it was scientific. It was realizing that the rules of science apply everywhere, and that they were more familiar with them than we were.
And is that one of the reasons why you went into the fields that you did, is because of that experience?
It made it a lot easier to go into the fields that I did. The people who know me well are always surprised that I'm a nuclear physicist, because they say I'm so much better at history and stuff than the physics. I mean, I got, you know, a perfect score on the GRE and stuff like that. But, you know, they always say, well, yeah, that's good. But like one publisher said that he never understood the Vietnam War until he read my unpublished manuscript entitled The Lord of the Nighttime, which was captured some of my experiences in Vietnam. And so
is that published?
The Lore of the Nighttime?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't published that manuscript. I haven't published that one yet. I don't have any plans to publish it right at the minute.
Okay, so...
Many of the stories in The Lord of the Nighttime are in Millennial Hospitality 3.
Okay.
The true story of how my good friend Kenneth E. Baker gave his life to keep me alive and so on.
Uh-huh. So... I've been thinking about this the whole time. Do you think that there was any kind of a genetic engineering taking place? Because you hear so much about these alien abduction things and whatever, and it makes you almost wonder if these tall grays were involved in something like that.
Not for the tall whites. The tall whites were very proud of who they were, and they enjoyed being who they were. And the idea of any kind of genetic engineering between the tall whites and the humans was simply out of the question for the tall whites. The same way that you and I have, or at least that I have, you know, absolutely no desire to do a genetic engineering experiment between me and chimpanzees, you know. That was kind of they were very proud of who they were, and they had no desire to fiddle with their genetic structure. The one thing that we did that did impress them was we heal up way faster than they do. They live 10 times longer than we do, but that means that if they cut themselves, that their body takes 10 times longer to heal. And it's a consequence of living 10 times longer. And so that was one way that they were kind of envious of us, that we heal so quickly.
Now, there's some other things that you mentioned, something about they go through growth spurts and this sort, and I've heard through some geneticists and whatever that when we go into space, our bones get soft. I'm wondering if there's a connection there between why they would, you know, as they got older, their bones, I mean, they didn't seem, were they brittle or were they just softer or what?
No, as they age, as I described before, when they get the equivalent to about a human 40 years old, which for them is about 400 years, they start growing again, and so by the time they get to be 600 or 700 years old, they get very tall. That's why I call them the tall whites. But their bones, the reason their bones get brittle is because their organs do not grow in the same proportion as their skeleton. You see, so there comes a time after 600 or 700 years or somewhere in there where they go through another growth phase and their organs will no longer support the body, their body that tall. And, of course, when you look at the mechanics, how do you have to work the muscles? For a person 5 feet tall, if he's built real strong, you know, he can be like a weightlifter. But if he's like 7 feet tall and he tries to reach, you know, you can't make the muscle strong enough for him to be able to reach down and grab the same weight that, say, a short guy would, because of the mechanic, you know, the forces on the muscles, the ligaments, and so on become so great that pretty soon, if a really tall guy starts doing that, he'll start tearing muscles and bone. Well, they have that same problem because they have to live by the same rules of organic chemistry and physics and so on that we do because they're just flesh and blood creatures. So, you know, whereas a person like Range 4 Harry at, say, 5'11", might be able to reach down to the ground and just pick up a rock or a twig and stand up again, a guy that's an older guy that's like 8.5 or 9 feet tall, well, now for him to go down and do the same thing, that's a horse of a different color. So, being older and taller and stuff had its drawbacks as well.
So, I'm still a little bit unclear as to did you have other people that had run into anybody that had any similar experiences to you that really were able to tough it out like you did, or I just find it so interesting that
There were range maintenance men. You know, I describe them in my three range maintenance men that I describe in my books, like the one who was from the one I describe in book one who got up and said. And asked me, when I first went up to Indian Springs, asked me what I thought UFOs were, and I said, you know, I gave him the answer, I gave him the book, and he said, no, you're wrong, they're dug in on the mountain north of here. He knew they were real, and the other two maintenance men with him knew they were real, but they never had the courage to go out there alone among them. Uh-huh. They always went out, the three of them, together. And then whenever the aliens would come in close, they would the three humans would stand with their backs to each other so that the aliens couldn't come up behind them. And they used to think that I was, just the world's bravest person or the world's biggest fool. They used to think I was, they had tremendous respect for me because of my willingness to go out there just alone and not worry that the aliens would come up behind me. After that six month period, after I got to where I could talk to them, one of the first things I did was I negotiated with them. I made an agreement that they wouldn't come up behind me and scare me because I didn't, you know, because I scared easily. And conversely, I wouldn't come up behind them and scare them. That if I saw them, I would just stop where I was and sing one of my little songs, like by Ricky Nelson, It's Up to You, the song It's Up to You by Ricky Nelson, or one of those other songs, Sunshine Came Softly by Donovan, and so on. And likewise, if they saw me, they would make a sound like a meadowlark call or something and let me know that they were there so that we wouldn't scare each other. And so the range maintenance men were as close, they knew they were real. Although the head of the range maintenance men, he had gotten to where he could talk to him some. He would never do so alone. He would only do it with the other two men with him.
Did you ever have any kind of close call for a real scare with him?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear you.
Did you ever have a real close call with him in a scare or anything?
Book three, the end of innocence, the day that Pamela fired on me, by accident, where she thought she'd adjusted it, the weapon she was carrying to the sodium frequency, and thought she was going to give me, you know, the 120,000 volts AC in the nerves, and accidentally adjusted it to the iodine frequency, and just about killed me, almost bled me to death.
So it almost sounds like a taser.
Say again.
It almost sounds like a taser.
I'm sorry. There was quite a bit of static, and I didn't quite hear you.
Because it almost sounded like it was a taser.
It was done with microwaves, you know, mm-hmm. the weapon, you know, when they fired on you with the weapon, it would put out microwaves, but the microwaves were tuned to a specific frequency, like if it was tuned to the frequency of sodium, then that would discharge the nerves, like in your arm, if they were firing at your arm, and it would make it seem like you had touched a high voltage wire, see, so it was extremely painful, it was like a huge electrical shock. But it didn't actually burn you, although if they fired at your heart or something, they could easily kill you with it. On the other hand, the iodine frequency, if they fired at your neck, well, that would, it caused the iodine in, you know, the thyroid to, you know, the molecules that carry iodine and stuff to undergo a chemical reaction, and that would allow the blood to come through the arteries on your butt, you know, and you'd bleed to death through the arteries, the same way that you would if you had the Black Plague, you know, because the Black Plague changed the chemistry of the blood, and then people bled to death because the blood went through the arteries and bled under the skin. But, of course, the body can repair that very quickly in the case of the iodine, in the case of the iodine molecules, mm-hmm. if you have the time, you know, if you haven't bled to death in the meantime. And then there's the one for the calcium molecule, where if they fire on you with the calcium molecule, it won't put you to sleep. It'll just mean that your nerves are so relaxed, you don't fall down or anything. It's just that they're so relaxed that, like, if they fire on you with the legs, it means that you can't really move your legs. You just have to stand there. You know, you're not unconscious or anything. And then they had the weapon where they could electronically hypnotize you so that if they fired on you, like if they got a clean shot at your temples, then you were hypnotized, you know. But like all hypnotism, once you understood what was going on, you could break out of that one, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, see, so what they were doing, they were just doing with ordinary microwaves. They just happened to be very good at designing instruments that used microwaves.
Well, you know, there's a whole... You can see how you thought you were just going to be on an hour, and how easy it is to go the 2 hours, because
yeah.
There's so many questions there. The one thing that really still strikes me is how the uncharacteristic treatment of you by our government. From what I hear, so many other people go through that deal with that, and it almost makes me wonder if they have.
I'm sorry, you're really faint on this end, and I can hardly hear you.
Well, okay, is that any better?
Yeah, that's
okay.
Better.
All right. It almost makes me wonder if there wasn't some kind of agreement between them and our government because of the uncharacteristic way that you were allowed to speak out. And
oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I described that in book one. See, after the guy before me had been burned, that was the one of the agreements was between the tall whites and our government, was that I would be treated special. And the reason was because I had already saved the life of the teacher's little girl, and they had already gotten used to bringing the children around when I was there. And as I describe in book one, that from their point of view, when I would see them, I wouldn't, like, throw rocks or chase them or anything or become angry. I just thought I was going nuts, and so I would go in for breakfast, you know. See, so from their point of view, their children were safe when they brought them around me.
And apparently, since they live so long, maybe they have to keep their word for much longer?
That's exactly right. They're like Philadelphia lawyers. See, it's just like I describe in my books. They were real easy to make an agreement with, but once you made an agreement, then you had to keep it. And they meant like a lawyer, word for word. So, like for example, one of the first agreements I had with them was that the cable fence that separated the at Range 3 that separated the graveled area from the skip bomb area. I said, well, I won't. If I see you out there, I won't cross the fence unless you know that I'm coming, unless I make noise. And, you know, you guys, you know, before you cross the cable fence, make a noise and make sure I know you're there. Well, when you and I are talking about a cable fence out in the desert valley that's 10 miles wide and 40 miles long, you know, you and I would, you know, say, well, where's the fence? You know, from the point of view of you and I, well, you know, that we're talking about kind of like a broad 10-foot wide area or something. You know, we'd say, well, so what if I stepped across the fence and went a few feet and then stopped? They aren't that way. They're right down to the inch. Right down to the inch. The best example I can give is consider the over at the Desert Game Range. The rules for camping that were at the, which is a national monument, or a national, you know, which the park rangers are there. The park rangers say that it's okay to camp if you have a permit, and for one of those 2 weeks or whatever when the camping is permitted, it's okay to camp on the gravel road up to Sheep Peak, and it's okay to camp within 100 feet of the road. But, you know, when you're camping, the ranger will come out with a tape measure and actually measure measure how far your tent is from the road. Well, you know, you're in another desert valley that one's 50 miles long and 20 miles wide, and he's measuring it down to the inch, you know. And that's how the tall whites are, see.
I find that part interesting when you're dealing with most of the people that I have observed in our government and military, is it's they're great at breaking their word, and I find that real interesting to see that there is a creature that can keep them to their word, or appear to be, anyways. Does that, you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah. See, in book two, in books one and two, in the Olympic tryouts, the reason that they came down and grabbed me at range three and took me up to the main hangar, up to the scout craft hangar up in their mountain, wasn't because they wanted to do anything weird. It was because the day before, they had told the American government that I had fallen and broken my knee, and then I hadn't. It was just bruised real bad. And so the next day, they wanted to prove to the American government that when they said something, you could trust it. See?
Mm-hmm.
See? And, you know, so the American government, understanding that, the general and the doctors had gone out to the, had gone out to the scout craft hangar up at Area 54, and then had, you know, Harry and the guys come down and grab me and hypnotize me and take me up there, as I describe in book two. And then what they were doing is proving to the American generals that when the tall whites said that I had broken my knee, that they thought my knee was broken. That the American generals could depend on the tall whites to anything they told them was word for word perfectly true. You see.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very important to the tall whites, proving that the American generals, it wasn't a big deal for the American generals. It was a big deal for the tall whites to make
right,
sure.
Right, right. But what I'm just trying to put across is it's usually our word that is so that is not trustworthy as so much.
Oh, you noticed. the government, we run a guy for president, he says we'll never raise taxes, and I guess that's what we're not going to have, right?
Right? Right, but you know, Charles, I really appreciate you coming on and giving us this information, because, you know, I mean, it's quite unique, and obviously there's a lot to chew on here, and I appreciate it and hope, you know, you'll come back again.
Oh, yes, I really appreciate your having me on, and I really enjoyed it, and, you know, I'm always happy to be on and answer questions and stuff. I know I sometimes ramble a little bit, but I hope that I've covered areas that you would find interesting. And, you feel free to ask me any question you want.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and tell your wife thank you as well.
Oh, it was a wonderful time, and I'll thank you very much.
And it's millenniumhospitality.com, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, and that's where you'll find his books. And thank you very much.
And everything in the books is true and happened to me, yes.
Oh, okay, good night.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. This is KHENLP FM Radio.